What's fascinating to me, when you look at the different women's health topics, you see time and time again this clear disparity, especially for gynecologic health symptoms, but also for pain symptoms. Women historically have really been subjugated to a very specific role, and I think a lot of the focus of research dollars and research interests has been related to procreation and women. And I think the gynecologic issues and the pain issues have really taken a backseat.
Today, I'm so excited to talk to Dr. Leslie Farlan. Dr. Farlan is an assistant professor in the Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics at the Mellon Enid Zuckerman College of Public Health at the University of Arizona. Prior to joining the faculty, she was an instructor in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Harvard Medical School and in the Department of Epidemiology at the Harvard T. H. Chan School of Public Health, and served as the director of epidemiologic research at the Center for Infertility and Reproductive Surgery at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Her research program focuses broadly on women's health and can be categorized into three major themes: the intersection between women's reproductive health and chronic disease risk, etiology and risk factors for endometriosis, infertility, and polycystic ovary syndrome, and disparities in access to infertility care and fertility treatment utilization. Also here with me today is Kelly Heslin. Kelly Heslin is a senior research specialist at the College of Nursing at the University of Arizona. She has training in Earth System Science and Health Behavior Health Promotion and received her MPH from the Mellon Enid Zuckerman College of Public Health. She is a certified health education specialist and is currently working on skin cancer prevention research. Her interest in endometriosis stems from her own diagnosis at age 22, which led her to participate in local and statewide advocacy and support efforts. These experiences ultimately resulted in her returning to school to pursue a career in public health. Thank you so much to Dr. Farlan and to Kelly for being on the podcast today. Thank you so much for joining me today, Dr. Farlan and Kelly. I really appreciate you taking the time to be here.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, we're excited to be here.
So if I could have you, Dr. Farlan, talk a little bit about your work and how you got interested in studying women's health, that'd be great.
Sure. So I'm a reproductive epidemiologist, and I became interested in it through kind of a variety of mechanisms. So when I was an undergraduate student, I was kind of broadly interested in health and was thinking kind of going the pre-med route. And as I learned more what public health was and talked to women about their experiences with infertility, with endometriosis, with kind of these understudied and under-resourced gynecologic conditions, I kind of became more interested in the public health, specifically focusing on women's reproductive health.
Yeah.
And I guess the rest is kind of history. I don't know. I see my research specifically looking at, or kind of nicely situated in this area where it's very interesting biologically. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting epidemiologically. These diseases are complicated to study. And I think there's a lot of really important social justice work being done in this footprint. And so it's this nice combination where I think they're biologically complex, but also I'm able to kind of do more advocacy in this footprint as well.
Yeah, which is so important, especially in women's health, which oftentimes gets overlooked at times, which we're going to discuss a little bit more today. And Kelly, I just wanted to say thank you for joining us. I know that your interest in endometriosis started because you have a personal connection to it. So thank you for discussing that with us today. I know that's really personal. And if you could talk about how you got interested in this work as well.
Yeah, no problem. It's my soapbox. So yeah. I have no problem talking about it, which is really what led me to public health. So my background was not in public health or the health fields at all. I studied Earth System Science for undergrad. I worked in the environmental field for years, and then I had been diagnosed with endo when I was, I believe, about 22. I had one of the lucky stories of it only took me about 4 years of searching and trying to figure out what was going on and where this pain was coming from. Got my diagnosis, several surgeries later, the whole nine yards, and through that whole process, I was becoming more involved in advocacy efforts and support groups and just kind of seeing what needed to be done, where all those gaps were. And I realized that that was something I would like to focus on more full time. And then that led me to going back to school and pursuing public health. So
yeah,
it's interesting to think about, you know, thanking a disease for your career trajectory, but it's what I've heard from a lot of other people who work in this field as well, that their personal experience led them here.
So you mentioned that your diagnosis story or your journey with endometriosis was one of the lucky ones. Why is endometriosis so hard to diagnose? So you can talk about it from your personal experiences, and then Dr. Farland, you can talk about why is it so hard to diagnose from a clinical standpoint.
Absolutely. The general practitioners and the OBGYNs are not very well trained in endo, by and large. I also came from a very rural area, so I think that that was a big barrier. And I was fortunate enough to come from an educated background, middle class. I'm a cis white woman. So even though I was coming up against a lot of barriers with older male physicians who really, I don't think, had a lot of experience with this condition at all or much empathy for a female coming to them in pain. A lot of it was just getting brushed off as this is normal. It's not normal to have pain with sex for anyone who's listening. Don't believe that for a second. But, so because I am fortunate and educated, I was able to not take what everybody was telling me at face value. I was able to do research. I was able to find specialists and ultimately get the care that I needed. But on average, it does take between 7 and 10 years of a woman really searching for answers to receive that final diagnosis, which does have to come with surgery. So there's a host of barriers in that entire story.
Yeah. And then why is it so hard to diagnose clinically, Dr. Farland, when I do want to mention the prevalence rate for endometriosis is 10%. So that is, I think that's really high in my opinion.
Right. Yeah. And that's kind of our best guesstimate at this point. So those are women who are able to make it through the medical system and receive a diagnosis. So like Kelly said, it's really complicated. So even if you are self-aware enough to recognize that your symptoms are abnormal, you often hear stories of women talking to one doctor, their symptoms being dismissed, talking to another doctor, and it taking them multiple rounds of doctors, potentially being suggesting that they go to a different specialist. Kind of this pathway to diagnosis is not always linear. And so it's this issue of, first off, the patient has to recognize their symptoms. The community has to recognize their symptoms, being the family members, their friends, and all acknowledging that these are abnormal symptoms. And then their physician has to recognize the symptoms and diagnose them or refer them appropriately. And so all of these things need to happen, and so rarely do all of those happen in a quick timeline. Yeah.
There are also some cultural barriers as well, that sometimes women don't feel comfortable talking about this, or it might not seem appropriate to discuss, but this is something that you have to discuss with your physician, and especially since it's not a linear case, you do have to talk to multiple people around along your pathway to get diagnosed, so that can also be a barrier.
Absolutely, and if I can just also add in, so many of these symptoms begin when girls are quite young and in their adolescence, so sometimes that first barrier can be familial even, you know, and having a difficult time discussing these issues even just with a parent who has come from a background where they're not comfortable or used to discussing these things. So that's just added on, I think, to the rest of the barriers.
And a huge barrier is access to care issues. So we had, I think we've talked about this in every episode of the podcast so far, but for women's health especially, I think access to care issues really complicate this process of getting a proper diagnosis. So everything from having health insurance to being able to see a specialist, especially our system in the United States where you can't just go see a specialist right away, you have to be referred to one. So what are your experiences with how access to care issues impact getting a proper diagnosis?
So scientifically, what we often think about as kind of the clinical gold standard for endometriosis diagnosis is a surgical visualization of the endometriosis lesions themselves. Different doctors will have different feelings about whether that needs to be confirmed by pathology. But the fact that a surgery needs to be involved, I think, is a huge barrier to understanding who we capture when we're capturing that clinically confirmed endometriosis population. And I think when we think about where endometriosis research needs to go, a huge issue is trying to come up with non-invasive diagnostic techniques. And unfortunately, those aren't really there. So there's a large number of women in the world who have suspected endometriosis, but maybe it's not confirmed. And the difference between suspected and confirmed can have implications for reimbursement and for lots of things, even just how the woman conceptualizes her disease and tells people what she has or what she doesn't have. Yeah. So there's kind of all of these layers which I think make endometriosis really fascinating from a scientific perspective, mm-hmm. but also really frustrating from a women's advocacy perspective.
Definitely. So I want to take a step back and kind of go away from talking specifically about endometriosis to kind of more of a wide lens, talking about women's health. So some of the articles that have been coming out recently that I've seen in the news have been talking about women's health and women's pain not being taken as seriously as perhaps men's pain. And then if we want to go a step further, talking about minority women and how their pain is perceived even less so than their white women counterparts.
Yeah, I think it is. It's very hopeful, I think, now that I think a lot more attention is being paid to this. There's mm-hmm. a lot more coming out in the media. There are a lot more op-eds. There are a lot of people doing really good investigative journalism pieces about these issues. Maternal mortality has come up a lot, especially with women of color, and that's another arm to this whole thing, right?
Yeah, and I think one of the things that really propelled this to be discussed in the media was having women with really high profiles talking about their birthing experiences. So we had Serena Williams talking about how she was very close to dying during her childbirth process, and I think Beyonce said something as well, so I think that's a really important point.
Absolutely, and I would just say that you're right. I think that the sexism that is so baked into our society has so much to do with it. And the fact that women are just, we've always been seen as serving others. And so not only have our own concerns been sidelined, but they really are not seen as legitimate as men's concerns mm-hmm. are. And beyond just being really frustrating, it's super dangerous, right? Because we do see these issues with maternal mortality and a lot of the other comorbid conditions that come along with endo or can be confused with endo if there's not an actual surgical diagnosis mm-hmm. can be really dangerous and life-threatening too. So it's frustrating. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad that there's more attention being paid to it, but it does make you wonder what is it going to take, mm-hmm. right? Just because, you know, as a middle-class cis white woman, it took me being super headstrong and feeling comfortable doing that to achieve my own diagnosis and mm-hmm. to be able to better my health. I still had financial barriers to all of that. I still was in debt from having to put specialists on credit cards that were considered either out of network or mm-hmm. that these procedures were elective, you know, an elective procedure to be able to function day to day, right? And so, but I was fortunate enough to be able to go through all that.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine what it's like for people who have been so sidelined by the system to just to be invisible.
So the question that I asked in a very roundabout way was why don't we talk about women's health questions?
I mean, you did such a nice job summarizing. I think it's this really messy web of sexism. There's like a lot of disparity issues happening. But what's fascinating to me, and, you know, I'm not an expert on all of these topics, but when you look at the different women's health topics, you see time and time again this clear disparity, especially for gynecologic health symptoms, but also for pain symptoms, that, you know, if two individuals undergo the same surgery, they report the same level of pain, men are going to receive larger amounts of pain medicine compared to women. And that's just, you know, mm-hmm. one example. And there are so many examples, unfortunately, in the literature. Mm-hmm. What Kelly articulated earlier, I think, is this idea that, you know, women historically, as we all know, have really been subjugated to a very specific role. And I think a lot of the focus of research dollars and research interests has been related to procreation and women. And I think kind of the gynecologic issues and the pain issues have really taken a back seat. So we talked about this prevalence of 10% of women with mm-hmm. endometriosis. The reality is that 10% of women in the U.S. also have type 2 diabetes. Mm-hmm. And which disease do we hear about all the time, right? Which disease has so much funding? And that's not the perfect comparison, but the reality is that a large number of women are impacted by endometriosis and a lot of other mm-hmm. Gynecologic conditions, and we just don't talk about it, mm-hmm. we don't research it, and ultimately we don't fund it, and that kind of drives the other two pieces as mm-hmm. well.
So how can we, I mean, I'm going to ask you to like solve the world with this next question. So, but how do we go about trying to get more attention on women's health issues?
Well, I'm just so delighted this podcast is happening. This is like my wildest dreams. I mean, I think advocacy, talking about it, Lena Dunham, which mm-hmm. was semi-controversial, but I think she's brought up endometriosis a lot of times mm-hmm. in the media. And oftentimes when I, you know, in explaining my research to people, I say, oh, well, like Lena Dunham mm-hmm. has. And somehow that's a clearer segue. So I think talking about it and talking about it in the media is one really great first step.
Mm-hmm.
But there are so many. Yeah,
I agree. And you brought up funding, which I think is just, I mean, the numbers are there. I don't have them in front of me, but it's staggering, right? The amount of money that's being spent on research for so many other conditions mm-hmm. and not focusing on especially women's pain. And so often it's more related to, like you were saying, procreation.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of women's health has been so umbrellaed into maternal and child's health, which is 100% necessary and super important, but that's not the entirety of our lives, right? As mm-hmm. as people with a uterus. And mm-hmm. I would also just like to mention that, you know, endometriosis doesn't only affect people who identify as women. And that is just that disparity is almost too big to even comprehend, that there are so many people who don't identify right. as mm-hmm. women. Anybody with a uterus and ovaries can be suffering.
Yeah.
And the barriers that they face to care are just orders of magnitude higher than even just what your average woman is experiencing as well.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because there are already disparities that exist within women's health. And then if you take it for trans men or trans women, it gets even worse. But Dr. Farland, you mentioned the literature earlier, and there was a paper that came out from Bougie et al., and it was published in an international journal of obstetrics and gynecology, and it was talking about the influence of race and ethnicity on prevalence and presentation of endometriosis. You wrote a commentary talking about the disparity in endometriosis diagnosis between racial and ethnic groups, which was also published in the same journal. Can you talk a little bit about what inspired you to write that commentary and why you thought it was really necessary?
Yeah, so if you look at the history of endometriosis and the literature around endometriosis, there were a few big players who kind of started, I would call, the field. And those were Sampson and then also Meigs in the kind of 1940s. Mm-hmm. And some of their early work characterized the patients of endometriosis in these very, what I would consider kind of sexist and offensive ways.
Very offensive.
Very offensive.
Yes. Okay, we can all agree. Very good.
Yes.
Part of it was there's consistently been a relationship between endometriosis and number of pregnancies and timing of pregnancies. And so because of that, endometriosis was kind of categorized at an early point as being a disease that's affecting older, affluent women who are delaying childbirth, mm-hmm. who tend to be private patients. And so private patients was kind of synonymous with white patients. And so this kind of stereotype of an endometriosis patient emerged. And I think what was scary and what I reinforced when I was writing this commentary is there are descriptions of endometriosis patients as recently as the 1980s,
mm-hmm.
kind of using these same kind of caricatures. And so what scares me is that the workforce that is diagnosing endometriosis, that is meeting with patients one-on-one, still may have these kind of caricatures in the back of their heads.
Yes.
Or were trained by people who had these kind of overt caricatures. So mm-hmm. I think that's kind of one of the very complicated things. So the article that I was writing a commentary on was this meta-analysis. And the meta-analysis found that Black women as well as Hispanic women were half as likely to have an endometriosis diagnosis. And so I hope what we conveyed in this commentary is when we interpret these findings, we have to think critically about what they mean. So for other gynecologic conditions such as fibroids, we do see a very clear difference between African-American women and white women. And the mechanism behind that difference is not necessarily disparities like it is for endometriosis. And so when we see this very clear difference between racial ethnic groups, and this was a study combining data across the entire world, so not mm-hmm. just U.S. data, we have to think about, okay, what is driving these disparities and how they should be interpreted kind of from this context of we need to make sure that everyone feels comfortable recognizing their symptoms, talking about their symptoms, and then those symptoms have to be treated appropriately. Mm-hmm. And so every step of that pipeline has to be in place to receive a diagnosis. So when we see these disparities, my interpretation is, okay, something in this kind of pipeline or this link is malfunctioning, right?
I'm so intrigued. I'm so happy that you're here because I am really curious about the data behind these. So I'm so excited I'm so glad that you're here to speak about the data going into these. So are you finding any concerns about the data themselves and how they're collected? I mean, are you worried about just what isn't even present in the data before you were even worried about how they're being interpreted?
Yeah. So when you look at the studies that were included in the meta-analysis, the vast majority were coming from specific clinical settings, right? So we're assuming that all of those barriers to accessing care have already been surmounted to be captured. I think the other thing that's important to highlight is the majority of these studies did not have the initial intention to capture a disparity in endometriosis. So they're lumping studies from across the entire kind of world of endometriosis research where maybe, you know, in table one or kind of in the very first descriptive table, they're categorizing a disparity, but the purpose of the study is not necessarily to categorize a disparity. So not a lot of work has been done about talking about the disparity, thinking about why it exists, and how we can fix it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just to go back to what you said, I'm really glad that you mentioned the underlying beliefs that different healthcare professionals may have. And I want to clarify that it's not going to a healthcare professional and having them be racist and like outwardly have that. It's an unconscious bias. It's not something that the clinicians go in thinking about, right? So just, you were talking about the caricatures that were present in the literature beforehand. It was described as typically our patients with endometriosis appear to have an intense desire to excel. They are usually well-dressed and have trim figures. So that's one of the descriptions. And then in your commentary, you explained how that was sexist, classist, and racist. But it is that unconscious belief that a lot of people have when they're studying medicine. So at what point do we combat these unconscious biases that people, you know, get stuck in their brains? So what point of the education system or during their training do we have this kind of intervention to reduce those biases?
I think at every point. Yeah. I don't know if that sounds like too naive, but I think the reality is that not only do OBGYNs need to have intensive training, and many of them do, and the training today is much better than it used to be, but the reality is that primary care doctors, gastroenterologists, a lot of people are diagnosed because they're having bowel symptoms or other pain symptoms. Pediatricians also need to recognize endometriosis. I think aside from the racial ethnic disparities, some of the early research looking at prevalence of endometriosis showed the highest prevalence at around late 30s, early 40s, which makes sense, right? Because in public health, we remember that prevalence is incidence and duration. So it makes sense we would see a peak at that older age, but it means that many pediatricians aren't trained in endometriosis symptoms. They're not asking patients about their periods and their period pain, and so we're missing a lot of women. There was an international study that asked women when they first experienced symptoms, and something like 65% of women reported experiencing the first symptoms of endometriosis before the age of 20. So this isn't actually a disease of the mid to late 30s. This is a disease of all of adolescence and early adulthood. And so if we can capture it earlier, if we can diagnose it early, maybe we can better treat it.
Yeah, I could not agree more. So for my internship project when I was working on my master's, that was what I looked to do. So I surveyed, and boy, at women with endo, they're an amazing group, right? I don't know if you've experienced this as well, but we all want to talk about it because we all want people to hear and listen. And we want to share our experiences, right? Because we want to help other people hopefully avoid them. So I was very fortunate to work with a specialist in the Bay Area and had access to his entire patient group. And they were so fantastic. I was able to put out a survey essentially asking them those same questions. When were your first symptoms? And just getting their opinions. What do you think would have helped you along the way? And so many of them said they just wish they had personally known that it wasn't okay. They wish that their physicians had and their pediatricians, but they said they wish that they had just received any kind of education about it themselves so they would have felt more aware and more comfortable talking about it. So I ended up designing a program for it. Education of adolescent girls, but, you know, in thinking about it further and in further education and further research, I think that educating everyone, right, who is either potentially going to become a patient or become someone who treats a patient. Mm-hmm. If everyone is learning about how common this disease is just at a young age, and it's just, it's in health classes, it's in sex ed, you know, and obviously we have a long way to go with how we talk about sex in general in this country and how we introduce all these topics. Mm-hmm. But I think that just introducing it to everyone, yeah, because everyone is going to touch somebody with this disease in some way or another. They are going to be your partner. Mm-hmm. They're going to be a family member. They're going to be a friend. They might be a patient. It might be that person themselves. So,
yeah, that's really well stated.
Oh, well, I have a couple things I just wanted to add. I mean, it's fascinating as someone who studies endometriosis, you know, you'll introduce yourself in social contexts, and so many times women will come up to me like, let me tell you my story. Wow. And I love it and I hate it. So I love it because, of course, I think we need to talk about it more. Mm-hmm. But what's fascinating is, you know, we'll be in a group of friends and none of their friends knew they were experiencing this. And the same is to be said for infertility and other gynecologic conditions, that we as a society don't talk about these things. So it means that a lot of women don't know what normal is, right? Mm-hmm. There's no baseline to say, okay, you know, my periods are so severe that I feel like I can't play sports. Mm-hmm. And we're not talking about that. And so we can't have that reference point to say, okay, this is abnormal.
Yeah.
I also wanted to jump in and reinforce the idea of medical training. Yes. So I'm not exactly sure how much exposure doctors get currently in their training to endometriosis. But the last time I heard, it was something like 1 day of medical school. It's an incredibly small amount. I don't know if your listeners are participatory, but if anyone has experience, and I'd be so curious to hear how maybe the curriculum has changed. But I think oftentimes it's relegated to, oh, you will learn about that if you become an OBGYN, mm-hmm, or specifically, you know, someone who specializes in gynecologic surgery. Yeah. So it becomes very, very specialized. And the reality is, in order to diagnose, everyone has to be taught about this condition. Yeah.
And I think the best way to go about changing that med school curriculum would be to be putting out more research papers and literature showing how necessary it is. And it's frustrating. It's frustrating for sure. But I'm glad that you mentioned just, I think, talking about it. That's a really simple answer. But if we could get the same attention, like you mentioned diabetes, if it has the same prevalence rate, that would change everything.
Yeah, I think the normalization, and that's where there's a lot of opportunity, right? Mm-hmm. So if you want to see it as a glass half full, there's right, endless opportunity to work on normalizing it. But it also takes a lot of time and money, frankly, right, to get the job done. So I think it really does circle back to funding, but you know, funding is also about awareness. Yeah. And so
how does access to birth control issues affect women who suffer from endometriosis? So I'm not super well versed in the treatment for endo, but I do think that's like a first line treatment that often gets prescribed. Mm-hmm. So how does not having access to birth control impact a woman's life or quality of life?
Yeah. I think we can both speak to it. I think that it just is. It does. Yeah. There's just no doubt about it, because it is often the very first line, well before a surgical diagnosis is accomplished. If you present with painful periods, they're going to suggest that you go on hormonal birth control, and it can fail, it cannot work many, mm-hmm, many, many, many times. And that was my experience, was just, I said at some point, you know, this is not, you guys, this is not working.
Yeah.
Like, this is not the case. And for some women, it's enough to abate their symptoms. And which again, though, right, that mm-hmm leads to, did they have endo at all? I guess regardless if symptoms are abated, that's a win for them. But mm-hmm, but it's a lifeline for a lot of people who don't have access to specialists, who don't have access to further care or any even just information or a network of people that they feel comfortable talking to. If it's a lifeline.
I feel like every couple of months when we are relitigating the ACA, it comes up. The birth control issue comes up, if it should be free for everybody or not. And then it's so frustrating and disheartening to see so many women yelling, I need birth control, not for any sort of sexual reason, but because I have endometriosis or a host of other illnesses and diseases that the medication for it is hormonal birth control.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. It's a medication.
Yeah.
It is a medication that's prescribed for so many conditions.
And it's unnecessary for people to even be screaming about their own personal pain and stories just to get legislators to listen to it. But unfortunately, that's like the place that we're at.
Well, what makes me nervous, too, is the adolescent girls who birth control for in many areas of the country and by many providers is not even considered an option for the pelvic pain. So even if girls are presenting and say, hey, I recognize this is as abnormal, their parents or their providers may not feel comfortable thinking about birth control as a medicine to treat the condition. And I think that's where I get really sad about all of kind of the lost time that people spend trying to get diagnosed, but also, you know, not participating in activities that they
like. Yeah, in sports or going to school or just, like, being able to, you know, participate in life and life activities, which is oftentimes something men don't really have to think about.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree. It makes you wonder if, you know, if it was just repackaged and called something else,
right?
Then it would, nobody would care. We're going to start your daughter on this, you know, this many milligrams of of this medication, and we're going to see if it helps her symptoms. If it were presented like that, would people be screaming and crying about it?
Yeah. This is a million-dollar idea. Let's repackage birth control as something else.
Just repackage it.
Yeah, that's definitely a really important point. So we are kind of on a sad note, but let me change the tone of this conversation. So what are you hopeful for the next decade? How do you think women's health and medicine can improve in the upcoming years?
Oh, man. I'm hopeful for a lot of things. I'm definitely an optimist. But I think what we've talked about today is unfortunate synergy where we aren't really able to diagnose the disease. We haven't talked a lot about treatment, but the reality is that treatment options are not so great for the disease. And we don't really talk about the disease. And so being able to kind of tackle all of those pieces at once where we talk about it, we're able to diagnose it in an efficient way that isn't invasive, we're able to treat it sufficiently would be amazing. Something we talked about a little bit is how physicians interact with patients. And I wanted to circle back to that because I forgot to bring this up. You know, the reality is that oftentimes we're in a doctor's office, and I know I am very guilty of this, where the doctor feels rushed and they ask, oh, do you have anything else? And even if I had something else, I don't bring it up, right? Okay. So I think the reality for endometriosis and for pelvic pain and for gynecologic conditions is we need to make sure questions about these diseases are asked by every doctor.
Yes.
Every doctor in the emergency room, every doctor in a primary care setting. And they're not currently. There are lots of questions that are asked, but those questions are not asked. And I think that would do wonders as a kind of a very low-level intervention that we could do to help make sure that these people are being screened and recognized.
Yeah, definitely.
That makes a lot of sense. And like you said, such a low-level intervention where it's one tweak to an existing protocol, right?
Because of course,
isn't there domestic violence?
Yes, and we've seen we've seen this work for mental health care. You go to campus health, you now have to take that depression screening. So I think that it's a very low level intervention that could make a huge difference.
Absolutely, It just makes you wonder about your the what ifs of back in the day if this had just been something that had been asked, and then if the answer was understood to the point that it could lead to potential intervention down the road, right?
I think
that's the other thing but I think you're right. Just adding a question, I
know. That's a very popular public health answer. It's like, add a question to an existing survey. But what about you, Kelly? What are you hopeful for in the next decade for, you know, the field of women's health in general?
I'm very hopeful because I think that we're fed up.
Yeah.
I think that a lot of people are fed up, and I think that a lot of people are finding more of a voice and a space for their voice to be heard. Largely, you know, you think of the Me Too movement, and you just think of everyone who's just so sick of being put on the back burner. So I am really hopeful. I'm super hopeful with these next generations of professors, of researchers, of everybody who can potentially impact these issues for the better. I think that there are a lot of people who care. And as much as people, I think, are scared of this next generation and millennials are apathetic, I call BS on that.
Yep.
There are so many wonderful, intelligent, engaged people doing amazing work towards these fronts. So I'm really excited about that.
Yeah.
And I'm excited about just how technology and social media are connecting people at this amazing pace.
Yes.
And that just gets me really excited that connections can be made and contacts can be fostered and ideas for research and funding, you know, can be made. And there are nonprofits in the world now. The Endometriosis Foundation of America, which I saw you are receiving funding
from
them.
I did receive
a grant from them. I had more recently learned about their their foundation and their program. If you're not aware, that's the foundation that's run by Padma Lakshmi, who's the host of Top Chef, and she's her own, you know, she's famous in her own right, and she's been very vocal advocate for endometriosis awareness after her own struggles.
Yeah.
And yeah, so there are opportunities. It's happening.
I also think the advocacy piece is so huge, and something I didn't realize until grad school was that a lot of research topics are supported by federal mandates, and those federal mandates are put into place because people advocated for a specific disease and a specific cause. And so I think we as individuals interested in endometriosis can do a lot related to advocacy and making sure that people know that we care about this disease.
Well, March is Endometriosis Awareness Month. Okay, if anybody would like to hear about that, the awareness color is yellow. And there are some events nationally. I'm not sure what State of Arizona has been doing more recently, but March is Endometriosis Awareness Month. It's a good time to look on social media. A lot of people spread myths and facts because there's so many myths surrounding the disease. It's a good way.
That could be a whole new podcast. Yeah, I have strong feelings about that.
Tell me about it. Elaborate on that a little bit. I'm not familiar with any of these myths.
Well, just that. I don't even know where to start. I mean, the reality is that when you have a disease that we aren't good at treating, and there are complicated barriers, which we talked about, to treating, I hypothesize that that kind of creates a vacuum where then a lot of people can go on the internet and say things. And I think we as a society are not great at sorting through what's real and what's not real, especially related to science. For endometriosis, there's just lots of groups, some more legitimate than others, that oftentimes are kind of peddling their own ideas that aren't scientifically proven. And I'm not saying that all of the things out there aren't true. I'm just saying that we really need to focus on good science. And for some of these, just science, period, in terms of thinking about treatment for endometriosis.
Yeah.
And I can say, unfortunately, it spreads beyond just what you Google, because I cannot tell you how many health practitioners, both physicians, primary care physicians, OBGYNs, and nurses, who have said, oh, just have a baby.
Yep.
And it's just appalling, to hear that, because it's factually completely inaccurate. And there's no cure for endometriosis. There's no established cure, and for sure, just having a baby. Can you imagine? You're in debilitating pain. That's why you're seeking help, and the person you're seeking help from is telling you, just add an infant to the mix.
Yep.
And everything will be fine.
Sex is painful. Yeah.
And yeah, exactly. And yeah, sex is painful. I mean, it's just a host of them. That's the worst, I would say, that I've heard, especially from practitioners.
That's
horrifying. Just have a baby. But hysterectomy is not a cure. The lesions exist outside of the uterus, for one thing.
Yes.
And they can be throughout the entire abdominal cavity. I mean, there are some other crazy horror stories that are very rare that I won't go into. But hysterectomy is not a cure. You hear a lot of them in those groups. So,
yeah, I mean, I'm gonna get on a pedestal quickly about hysterectomy, because I think not only for endometriosis but for fibroids and other gynecologic conditions, it's unfortunate that we think about removal of an organ as a first line treatment for a lot of these things. And again, I think it's an issue of lack of funding, lack of research. A lot of these surgeons are trained in this and they were taught just to do a hysterectomy, but I would just like to reinforce that hysterectomy should not be considered kind of a first-line treatment for lots of things, especially for endometriosis, because biologically that doesn't make sense.
Well, we brought the mood of the podcast down again.
Oh, sorry. Gosh darn it. I will say two happy things. So the Endometriosis Foundation of America, I think, does a lot of great work around advocacy. And for Endometriosis Awareness Month, they often will have sessions specifically in New York. But I believe they have they're able to broadcast those as well for both patients and for practitioners and clinicians who are interested in it. I also know they have a curriculum. I don't know how much of your curriculum was based off of theirs or completely separate, but they do have a curriculum that they are rolling out in New York City that seems to be successful.
That's awesome.
Focusing on, you know, how can we talk about these issues with young women and girls, and just make sure that we talk about periods.
Yeah. That kind of goes right into the last thing I want to discuss. Our audience for this podcast is the public health workforce. So folks that work in public health departments, maybe not necessarily in a clinical setting like the hospital or in research or academia, but kind of the public health workforce at large. So what can people who work in the public health workforce, how can they become advocates in their daily life? I know we talked a lot about discussing the issue, but how can they promote women's health in general in their day-to-day jobs? So if you think about all the different jobs that are in the public health workforce.
It's hard to, because there's so much diversity in those positions.
Yes.
But I would say, I think we would probably be surprised at how many opportunities there are within everyone's varied careers and mm-hmm. their day-to-day projects, you know, depending on what they touch, or their colleagues even, you know, just mm-hmm. looking to your colleagues if you're not yourself involved in women's health programming or data collection, data management, data analysis, anything like that. Mm-hmm. I bet you know someone who is.
Yeah.
Right? And just... Oh, yeah, it's hard. There's so many.
There's so many, so many positions, yes. But that's like the goal of my podcast here, since we are reaching the public health workforces, to kind of get that information that we've just been discussing today out there. So we're having those conversations more.
I think in my mind, just making sure that these conditions have a seat at the table. Oftentimes, like we talked about, there's an emphasis on maternal child health under the public health umbrella, and that often excludes gynecologic health. And so just making sure that, you know, when we're thinking about women's health, we have resources and we're talking about gynecologic health, normal periods, endometriosis, and what that all means as well.
Yeah.
So, I would say also one thing we haven't brought up, but the economic impact of the disease is
staggering. Yeah, please talk
staggering.
About that.
And I think that if all of the other appeals to humanity and morality fail, money talks in a lot of places as well. So if anyone has the ear of people, you know, whether it's legislators all the way down to people working at health departments and the city level and the county level, just it's a large impact on the economy of at every scale, really. Lost days of work, the cost of treatment, and the cost of failed treatment and repeated treatment. It's
shoot too.
Right. And I think it speaks to so many levels, as you said, right? It's the treatments, but it's also the quality of life, the lost days of work, the missed hours of work. And so as a community and as a society, it is a public health issue. We just often don't think about it.
Definitely is a public health issue. Are there any other last things we want to discuss or plug in?
I'm sure there are. This topic, I think that we could both talk about it from different perspectives, which I'm so excited to meet you. It's great to have other people stepping up and like casting light on this. So thanks for having us.
No, I was really excited to have this episode about women's health and step on my own soapbox. Are there any last...
No, I'm just, just to reiterate, I'm delighted that this was the topic. I think when you approached me about a podcast, I was like, oh, no one's going to be excited about endometriosis, despite the fact that I'm really excited about endometriosis. So I hope we inspire people to learn more and do more research and get excited. You know, just to reiterate that I hope everyone feels empowered to be advocates for their own health, for their family's health, for their friends' health. You know, intense period pain is not normal, and so if you're experiencing that, if you're experiencing pelvic pain that's not associated with menses, you know, please say something to your providers.
Yes, please.
And hopefully
I'll try to find some resources.
That'd be fantastic.
And I welcome anyone to contact me as well. Sana, you can put my
email
in there, just if anybody has any questions or doesn't know where to start, or they want to, you know, do more or learn more, would love to talk with you.
That's great. Thank you so much. I just want to say again, thank you so much for talking about your own personal journey with endometriosis. I know that can be hard to do at times, but we really appreciate how open that you've been with discussing your personal struggles with the system and the disease itself. So thank you again for coming on. And Dr. Farland, thank you so much for the work that you do. I think that's the right direction we're going in, is just putting as much research and publications and yelling about this from the rooftops as much as we can. So thank you so much for the work that you do, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you are looking to obtain continuing education credits for listening to this podcast, please head to moodle.publichealth.arizona.edu and click on the Keeping Up with Public Health tab in the WR PHTC section and take the post-evaluation survey for this episode. This podcast is supported by the Western Region Public Health Training Center. You can find more of our work at www.wrphtc.arizona.edu. You can also find us on Twitter at WRPHTC. A special thank you to Eric Healy for editing and producing the show, in addition to creating the music for each episode.